off. In the past, we've had to make our own entertainment. That's why there's so many of us. What an artistic heritage we have here in the North. A heritage of poetry. What a lot we owe to people like Wordsworth and Johnny Hackett. What magic in those words. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats so high o'er dale and hill. When all at once I saw a crowd shouting, Liverpool 3 and Manchester 0. Are there any United supporters in? United, it's a biscuit.
Not the best gag in the world, but the sort of gratuitous inclusion you get in programmes presented by Manchester City supporters. Ken Dodd, of course. England's greatest living comic? Possibly. He was born in Knotty Ash, Liverpool, in 1931, a coalman's son. But he soon realised he didn't want to spend his life humping sacks of nutty slack. He wanted to be in showbiz. He began his career as a ventriloquist.
My father wrote the scripts and I got a ventriloquial figure for a birthday present. And my first appearance was at, I'd be about 8 or 9 years old, at St. Edward's Orphanage. And from that, the father superior gave me half a crown. 3 months later, I did a show for the Parent Teachers Association at Knotty Ash School, and the headmaster gave me a shilling. And I learned there, you see, I had to learn a very, very important lesson in show business. You have to learn to take a cut gracefully.
Ah, yes, the money. We'll come back to that. He started to do all right, did Doddy. Ventriloquist by night, door-to-door hardware salesman by day. And, as Les Dawson discovered selling vacuum cleaners, there's nothing like honing a hawker's patter to prepare you for a career as a comedian. And nothing like having a door slammed in your face to prepare you for the Glasgow Empire. But by the time he became a comic, he was nothing if not prepared. He'd been thinking about it for long enough.
I wanted to be a comic when I was about 14. How does one comede? What is being funny? So I had to sort of look back into my mind, and my idea of being funny was to be a clown, to be a burlesque. And I used to watch these singers in those days using, On the Road to Mandalay, and that stuck me, that was ready for sending up. So I used to do that, and All Together in the Floral Dance, and Granada, those sort of songs. And that was my idea of burlesquing. I used to call myself Professor Yaffle Chuckabutty, operatic tenor and sausage knotter.
A quality act and no mistake. How could he fail? Especially with looks on his side as well.
I am a sex symbol. I'm a sex symbol for women who don't care. When you're a Casanova like me, you have to keep yourself in trim. You see me in Baywatch. I would imagine all the exercises every morning in front of the television is up, down, up, down, up, down, then the other eyelid. I did 25 minutes running on the spot this morning. Had me braces caught in the banisters.
And the teeth. What about the teeth? Even Shane McGowan would have done something about those.
Oh, the teeth, yes. Well, the teeth, that was part of trying to be different. I wanted to try and ride my bike with my eyes shut. And you can, oh, yeah, for about 6 yards. And then, boom, the curb, over the handlebars. I could have had them straightened, you see. My agent nearly had a heart attack. They said, oh, it wouldn't be you, Doddy, without your sticky-out teeth.
Relax, girls, he's spoken for. The way he looked made Ken Dodd unique. He was never going to be like anybody else, but that didn't mean he didn't have his role models.
Every boy who wants to be an entertainer, it's like his boys who want to be engine drivers or boys who want to be pilots. We all have our own heroes, and you look at your hero, whoever he is, and you emulate it. You try to be like your hero. My heroes were Arthur Askey, Rob Wilton, Tommy Handley, great rapid-fire delivery. I'm very proud to say that I learned a great deal from him, and I sort of invented things like Tutti Filarious and Plumptious and Discombobulated.
Oh, what a glorious night for sneezing through letterboxes.
What a beautiful day for all the men on holiday. Try filling your trousers up with Neapolitan ice cream, balancing a cherry on your napper, and saying to your missus, how's this for a knickerbocker glory?
What a glorious night for filling a top hat with peanuts.
All the ladies, when you're down on the beach, what an outrageous day, girls, for putting your bikini on back to front and frightening the life out of the deck chair attendant.
Doddy studied Tommy Handley and countless other comic idols and analysed what it was that made their comedy work. He read books on humour, researched the history of clowning, and when he put everything he knew into his own act, it was something special. Former BBC Light Entertainment producer Jim Casey.
What I will say about Ken Dodd is he is the greatest stand-up comic I've ever seen in my life. And that includes Trinder, Ted Ray, even the great Max Miller. For me, Ken is the best. I've never seen anybody get as many laughs in a theatre or destroy an audience like he can. He's phenomenal.
Phenomenal, yes, in the theatre. But on radio?
When I joined the BBC, I said to the boss man then, I said, the funniest man in this country under 50 is Ken Dodd. And I said, I don't know what you do with him on radio, but I think you should do something. So he rang Ken and said, come to the BBC and we'll work on a script with you and give you a broadcast. Come at 10:30. Well, anyone else would have been camped out at 6 a.m, you know, for their very first broadcast. And Ken arrived an hour late. When he said about his car and something, I think we believed him then. And, of course, he's been late ever since.
Bad timekeeping, the star turns prerogative. But if it's all right to be late when you're a star, when you're still trying to make your name, you get there early. Not Ken. Subterfuge was called for.
I realised what the setup was, so I had the contracts altered. So everybody's contract said rehearsal 12 o'clock. Ken Dodd's contract said rehearsal 10:30. So he used to arrive at 12:15, thinking he was nearly 2 hours late.
But if his inability to stick to a schedule was a frustration for the producers, his treatment of time as an abstract concept was a bonus for the punters.
The other thing about time is, once he gets on, you can't get him off. Man, the audience never want him to go off, but sometimes the orchestra would like him to go off, or somebody, because they want to go home. But the public never do.
Lawyer and friend, a welcome combination, Rex Makin.
He's always late, and he lets the audiences out late. In fact, he imprisons them. He will tell you this at the beginning of a show. You'll be lucky if you get home before breakfast. And theatre managers shudder because they've got to pay their staff extra for keeping the theatre open while he goes on and on and on.
Of course, Doddy may appear daft as a brush, but he'd have to be daft as a cortege of road sweepers to stay on if the laughs weren't coming. But the laughs did come, and that was addictive.
Your top lip goes stiff and sticks to your teeth, and you start going, hobble, 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 and you find yourself talking all sorts of rubbish. But when it's going, there's no sensation, there's no ecstasy like standing on the stage and seeing an audience rock with laughter.
A comedian needs a good sense of timing. That usually means getting out of the back of the theatre before the audience gets round to the front. That's all I've used, but show business can be very hard, love. The heady excitement of finding a star nailed to the door of your dressing room and thinking to yourself, oh, so that's what happened to Jimmy Tarbuck.
Not every gag is an absolute gem, although any joke at the expense of Jimmy Tarbuck is always welcome. But Ken's style doesn't depend on having a few decent gags and eking out an act through expert timing. Frank Carson used to have a catchphrase, it's the way I tell 'em. With Doddy, it wasn't especially the way he told them. It was the sheer numbers in which he told them. He literally battered the audience into submission. Jim Casey.
It's unusual, it's unique. He bombards the audience with comedy. He destroys them until they give in. I mean, he says that. He says, give in, you see. And in the end, they do. They finish up laughing at anything. I want... was doing a show many years later with him, a radio show, and I laughed in the box while I was watching it. And I turned to my secretary and I said, what am I laughing at? It's a lousy line and I wrote it 10 years ago. But he got me going so much, I finished up laughing at this line.
But if his battering ram approach suggests a lack of finesse, his live performances were a masterclass in the grace of the clown. In many ways, he belongs to a tradition that goes back donkey's years. Producer of the Ken Dodd series on BBC television, John Fisher.
He is very much that modern-day Puck, that Robin Goodfellow, that sprightly spirit, you know, who can get away with mischief. He is part of that surrealist tradition, which he emphasises brilliantly by the visual accoutrements, the zany costumes, the wacky hair, just his general demeanour, a body that is capable of doing most amazing physical things. Ken Dodd All comedians, all great comedians have a gift of expression. Ken's gift for expression extends beyond facial expression. His whole body, his legs, his arms, will convey, almost by semaphore, a comic point.
Apart from the encyclopedia of gags, though, and the funny hair, and the funny body language, oh, and the funny teeth, apart from all this, Ken had other weapons in his comedy arsenal. The props. In particular, the celebrated tickling stick, a feather duster used to emphasise and gesticulate. It might not sound like the stuff of legend, but it passed into the national psyche. For years, it was obligatory when picking up a feather duster to stick out your front teeth goofy fashion and shout, "Ho-ho, missus, what a tatterfalarious day, and how tickled I am!" But the tickling stick, like everything Dodd did, had a studied purpose. What do you do with your hands on stage?
It started off as a feather duster to begin with, and I used to say it was a tickling stick, partly because the first thing you have to do when you go on a stage, anywhere, because you get a bit excited and hyped up, is you have to control your hands. So the first thing you do is grab a prop. Now, my props were to hold the tickling stick, and that sort of anchored you down for a bit.
The tickling stick, and it's between his legs, and it's all, it's part of the sort of, what I call, honest vulgarity of the old days. It's the kind of thing people say, oh, you can't take offence at him. That sort of reaction, which is wonderful.
My style of humour really is trying to be very, very happy, or being very, very happy. I am very, very happy myself, and try to communicate that to an audience.
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that we possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness.
I wanted to be a family entertainer. I wanted to find a point of communication with children. And I invented the Diddy Men. They all looked like my little Uncle Jack. Uncle Jack was my great uncle. And he was quite a small man. And he loved his pints. So he had a bit of a tummy on him. And wore a bowler hat. So all my little cartoons all came out like the Uncle Jack. That's how the Diddy Men. And that's how I developed this style of... I don't like to offend people, you see. I wouldn't tell any joke that really makes people go, ooh, like that. And I wouldn't tell a joke that the children can't explain to their parents.
We are the Diddy Men, 50-50 Diddy Men. We are the Diddy Men who come from naughty Ash. Our Diddy hearts are dutiful, our tummies are jambotiful. In accents many and various, we're feeling tattyfalarious. Merry and gay, wherever we are. A Diddy Ballet, a Diddy Ballet. We are...
They're very eccentric. He's got little legs and rather a large tummy and a very nice expression. They're very lovable. Very nice people, they are. Diddy people.
I went to see Ken Dodd and the Diddy Men in the theatre once, and I remember thinking that I'd like to be a Diddy Man when I grew up. Well, actually, I wanted to be a Rolling Stone, but being a Diddy Man seemed a more realistic aspiration. After all, I had the natural attributes. How did their creator describe them? Little legs, large tummy, very lovable. Well, 2 out of 3's not bad for starters. Kids and adults alike love the Diddy Men and their demented dad Dodd, but their appeal was no surprise to Ken. He knew what was funny. He'd been training for years.
I read all I could on the subject, and this is what I discovered, that every since the beginning of time, since Aristotle, who said that the essence of the comic was a buckled mill wheel. And in a way, he's right with his symbol. He's quite right. But they all have these various theories. And all these theories, although they're about the same thing, they're all different. And so I made a little theory, and I discovered that when you say the word comedy, humour, you can't say it is. It's like saying the word music. It's like saying the word drama. It's a vast spectrum. It's a big thing. It's so big, I think, that the humour part of a person's mind, a sense of humour. What is a sense of humour? A sense of humour, I think, is a sense of proportion. It's the perception of the inconsistencies. It's the perception of the incongruities in life.
Much of Dodd's hard graft was done at home, and still is. Cataloguing and filing and indexing jokes in the endless search for the perfect act. Rex Makin.
Well, he has cards on everything, boxes and boxes of cards with jokes and all the rest of it. but he takes comedy very seriously.
I did keep a chart of how jokes were received all over the British Isles. I got this sort of pattern that in Scotland, in Glasgow, which is Glasgow Empire, the house of terror for English comics, they do like the one-liner, quick-fire, almost American gag.
Yes.
These are only generalisations. In Lancashire, they're like the droll comic, the poker-face comic. In Yorkshire, they're like the friendly type of comic. In the Midlands, they love singing comics. Like singer, you know, Harry Secombe.
Yes.
People who finish their act with a really good song. They like good singers. Now, in the place where they go in for all the singing, in Wales, the land of song, where they sing in the morning and they sing in the afternoon and they sing in the evening, it gets on your nerves. You'd think they... No, in Wales, they like the zany, wild... I think it's something to do with mean Celtic and that. Now, in London, they love their comedians. They regard them as totems. If you make it in London, if you behave yourself, you're set for life. For instance, Max Miller was beloved.
Oh, yes, yes.
Tommy Trinder, the Crazy Gang. Further south, if you go sort of Norfolk and Sussex, they like character comedians.
Regional tastes in comedy certainly do exist. And quite a few of the comics featured in these programmes conspicuously fail to recreate their huge northern success south of the Watford Gap. Ken was more aware of this than anyone. He'd done his research. He knew great northern comedians had died in the south, and he refused to risk his own reputation for years. Eventually, though, he gave in to public demand. They wanted him. It was hardly surprising. He was a big star. The song Tears went to number one in 1965. Ken gave in and appeared at the London Palladium. The perceived showbiz wisdom had it that if you succeeded at the Palladium, you'd really made it. A wisdom circulated by a showbiz mafia of Southerners it may well have been, but Ken took it in his stride and knocked them dead. But success on a national scale has only reinforced his northern roots and affection for his birthplace.
We know how to enjoy ourselves up north, don't we?
Yes!
A northern man likes nothing more than sinking down a pint of good, decent ale. And he doesn't care whose it is, either. Northern pubs are great for relaxing in. In fact, some blokes get so relaxed, they have to be carried home at the end of the night. And a lot of these northern nightclubs, you know, offer a variety of haute cuisine. You can get something in this club you can't get at any other clubs. Food poisoning.
I think the Liverpool sense of humour is due to two things. First of all, it's the northern objective outlook. We don't sort of take anything for just on face value. You know, we stand back and watch it for a bit. We have this sort of canniness of the north, perhaps even a little bit cynical, if you like. But we also have the warmth of the Irish sense of humour as well, and the zaniness of the Welsh, the wit of the Scots. And all this boiled up together in a big pan of scouse, coupled with the most wonderful thing in the whole world, enthusiasm. They have this most wonderful optimism and enthusiasm. Our favourite subject is playtime, which is this wonderful enthusiasm for everything. If you see a fat man running down the road, little kids watching him will shout, "Go ahead, mister, you're winning!" Not your silly old what's-it for running, or not go on, you be careful, or go on, mister, you're winning.
Tell you what, try taking all your clothes off, rolling in a huge steaming pile of mushy peas and saying, "How's this for the Incredible Hulk?"
Stage, radio, television, records. Ken Dodd has done the lot, but for the restless soul there are always new things to try. And for the restless comic, there's always the craving for acceptance in the world of straight theatre. As every circus clown secretly wants to walk the high wire, so every great comedian wants to be John Gielgud.
There must be other things to do, lots more things to do. Like this, I took this Twelfth Night part on of Malvolio and it frightened the life out of me, I must admit. Suddenly, as soon as I realised that I'd said yes, and as soon as I went into rehearsal, I thought, what have I done? Now, can I do it? And it made me, it was like a, you know, it was like somebody really... getting me at it.
Well,
I had to really buckle to and learn the lines, then I had to try and learn how to act, and it was a marvellous feeling to achieve.
And typically, Ken's Malvolio was nothing if not considered.
I've done a sort of six-month work because I was determined that this wouldn't be a sort of a horrible anticlimax, a horrible sort of flop. So I really did study the subject, the whole subject matter, and then I read as much as I could about Twelfth Night and, of course, as much as I could about the character of Malvolio, the various theatre criticisms, and I even wrote down as many phrases as I could from these analyses that would help me to think myself into the part before going on.
Ken Dodd's career may have been through many changes, but his private life has never really changed at all. He's never left Knotty Ash, and despite having had a long-term girlfriend in Anita, who died of cancer, he's never married. Possibly he was scared of deserting his roots. Perhaps he was frightened of what change might cost. Jim Casey recalls how he doesn't like to take risks, especially where money's concerned.
Well, Ken is very careful with money. That is another thing that is known in show business, which Ken would accept. I don't know any occasion when I've seen him lashing out with money for anything, not even himself.
Oh, up in Scotland. Now, they're supposed to be... Scots aren't tight, you know. They're very... a bit thrifty. I was appearing in Blackpool, and... I am this Sunday, actually. And I was... there's a shop next door that sells cottons and needles and haberdashery. And this Scotsman staggered. He said, hey, he said, yeah, do you sell thimbles? He said, yes, we sell thimbles. He said, how much are your thimbles? He said, they're 10p. He said, I gave us 25 thimbles. Oh, she said, you're going to do a lot of sewing. Ach, no, he said, we're having a wee party.
Doddy on the pecuniary quirks of the Scots. Hello, Mr. Pot. I'm Mr. Kettle. Stories of his meanness are legion. Rumour has it that he's been seen performing to assistants in motorway service stations to get bigger portions. Allegedly, he's been known to warm up soup on a camping stove in his dressing room. There's even the story that he kept £100,000 in news notes in case of civil war. Some, or indeed most of these tales, may be apocryphal, but there's no denying one of them. In 1989, he was accused of being a common law cheat and of false accounting, charges he strenuously denied.
But I was acquitted. I was found innocent of every single charge. And so I knew I was innocent. I knew I was innocent when it all started. I was only really irritated that I had to go through all the palaver to prove something which I knew, which everybody else knew, everybody connected with me knew all along. So it seemed a terrible waste of time, a terrible waste of money. But the end result was complete innocence of all the eight charges. Knotty Ash 8, the other lot nil.
And every cloud...
We got a new actor who would tell jokes about it, all about accountants. Never trust an accountant who wears mittens. And about solicitors, you know, do little and diddle 'em.
Oh, yeah. But though he laughed about it in public, in private the accusations left their mark. King of clowns he may well be, but what is it they say about behind the painted smile? Jim Casey.
Offstage is a very serious man. You will never get him... doing the funnies, and if there's a crowd of show business people there, you know, if there are four comics, Ken will be the one who's not being funny. I mean, I've been to things where Ken's been there, and various people have been getting up and doing things and thing, and Ken has not said a word. He's just sat there.
Well, he wasn't being paid, was he? Rex making.
I would say he is a private man with limits. I don't think you would get very close into his psyche without considerable effort. But that's the case with all clowns, isn't it? He's very philosophical off stage. And he works terribly hard. Those shows are terribly elaborate to put on. And he travels the length and breadth of the country. He boasts there isn't a theatre in the land he hasn't been in. And with his Christmas card, he sends you a list of his engagements for the following year.
And the ticket prices. But OK, he's not the first to get around in. Well, all right, he's not even the last to get around in. But that doesn't mean he's a selfish man, a man incapable of caring for others. Far from it. Jim Casey has witnessed his compassion and devotion.
I remember when Anita was dying, she had cancer, tumour on the brain, and my wife and I had gone to see her, and I was talking to the nurse. I said, "Is Ken coming?" She said, "He spends every night here." She said, "He comes here sometimes 11 o'clock at night or 12, And he leaves about 8 in the morning. Obviously, he was either not working or he was working close by. He couldn't work anywhere else. But she said, oh, he's here every night. He spends every night, all night, sitting at the bedside. He went up greatly in my estimation. I thought that's a wonderful thing. He'd arranged that he could be available every night.
If I give my heart to you, will you handle it with care? Will you always treat me tenderly and in every way be fair?
Well, that's it. That's it, Pagliacci. Laugh, clown, though your heart is breaking. That is a tradition. The show must go on. And his life is the show. His life is his performance. He has devoted his life to being what he is, and he will go on, even though he may be ill. I've known him to go on through illnesses. And he will go on regardless of his personal feelings.
And it's that dedication that has seen Kendard outlast and outshine more or less all of his contemporaries. And like all the great clowns, a shadow of his public persona off stage. Unreliable, serious, mean, so cherished and appreciated by his audience, and yet seemingly unable to cherish himself. And maybe that's where the greatness comes from. Perhaps without that central contradiction, Kendard, as we know and love him, would never really have existed. England's greatest living comic? Probably.
The whole basic philosophy of life is to be creative. I think that's what we're here for. I think that's the whole purpose of being alive, is to be creative. And I think in my own little way, to try and create comedy and to create perhaps a new joke or a new form of comedy, or even to say something in a new way, which is sometimes the same thing, is my main purpose of being alive.
Would you mind, please, facing the other way? No, it's nothing personal, but this is the ugliest audience I've ever had to play. I've played to a few, and dear, it's like a mass audition for Hammer Films. I mean, this plump lady down here in the miniskirt, she looks like a flower pot balanced on 2 pork sausages.
I always hope I'll have the ambition and the energy and the drive to want to do, to want to make people laugh, to want to be a comedian.
How Tickled Am I? Presented by Mark Radcliffe and produced by Bernadette McConnell.